Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What destructive force of nature costs the United States $400 billion a year? Here's a hint. It's a costlier problem than hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, and floods combined, and it is probably eating away at some of your most valuable possessions as we speak. The answer, of course, is corrosion, the oxidation of nearly every metal known to man that results in what is commonly known as rust. Most of us don't give it a lot of thought, but it's a huge concern for everybody from oil pipeline engineers to soda can makers to the United States military. Joining us to talk about the brave souls fighting to keep corrosion at bay is journalist Jonathan Waldman. His new book is called Rust, The Longest War. Johnny, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You got into this topic fighting a never-ending battle against the elements after you bought an old sailboat with some friends. Can you talk about the ways that that really drove home the kind of full destructive power of corrosion?
Yeah, it makes me giggle every time.
Well, that's good because most people cry.
It's true. First thing is, if you're thinking about buying a boat, gosh, I couldn't try to dissuade you more. I wish I'd named that boat Bad Decision. It was definitely a bad decision. It turns out the boat was just as old as I was. It was 30 years old, and this was 7 years ago in San Francisco. And two adventurous buddies and I figured we'd go for a big adventure and sail around the world. And this didn't happen partly because I lost all my money fixing the rusty things on the boat. But the funniest part, and I'm going to go into a little bit of detail here because it sort of indicates how bad it was, is one of my buddies is a really, really meticulous physicist. And he's really a good list maker. And so we bought this boat that we could afford, but it had all these problems. So on the very first day, we took it for kind of a marine version of a test drive. We left the marina and we went out, and the engine overheated because the heat exchanger was all caked up with rust, so it didn't cool off the engine. And my friend Matt took out his graph paper with the tiny little eighth-inch squares or quarter-inch squares, and he wrote down diagnose engine. And by the end of just that sea trial, I bet that list was half a page long, full of things. You know, the water tanks didn't hold water because they had rusted, even though they were made of stainless steel. The wires going through the bilge didn't conduct current, so the instruments on the top of the mast didn't light up or tell us how fast the wind was moving. Everything that could rust had rusted, and that was just the beginning of a two-year battle fighting corrosion. And I did this sort of journalistic trick where when all seemed lost and hopeless, I thought, well, I bet the Navy has bigger problems than I have. So I made my way to Norfolk, Virginia, to a conference called Mega Rust, which is paid for by our tax dollars. And there I met the nation's highest ranked rust official, and I heard how he thought of rust and how he wanted the Navy to combat rust. And that's when I realized, yes, this is a giant problem, and I'm not the only one suffering from it.
And he has actually saved, he and the people that are working with him have saved billions of taxpayer dollars over the years, and often with kind of no-brainer methods of corrosion prevention.
Exactly. He's done a lot of work with different facilities, infrastructure, and weapon systems for the Department of Defense. But the first thing was sort of go after the low-hanging fruit. So there's a lot of docks that were rusting away. There's a lot of aircraft that, you know, people would fly them and land them and just let them sit there. And he said, wait a minute, we should wash them off and then dry them and then cover them. And so you think, wow, that's amazing. The government's saving billions of dollars by inventing dehumidifier systems or covers or wash systems for billion-dollar weapons. But yeah, that's actually a big thing that was neglected until now. And one of my favorite anecdotes is, I think it was something like 50 or 60 years ago, the National Association of Corrosion Engineers heard from someone in the Pacific who he didn't know what to do about rusting Jeeps, so he just pushed them off the runway into the ocean. It was just like, well, what do you do?
Well, and of course, one of the realizations is that defense contractors had no particular incentive to make stuff that wouldn't rust and need to be replaced in a decade.
Yeah, and this is where Dan Dunmire is the name of the nation's
corrosion
highest
czar.
Corrosion. Yep, he's our corrosion czar. And this is where some of his words surprised me, because I sort of thought ahead of time that he would take money, funnel it towards doing the rational thing, and sort of consider that better than what we already do. But Dan said, no, I want to change the culture. I want to change the way we think about rust. We can't have a society where people make things to break and people profit because of corrosion. And he said, we got to break this cycle in the Pentagon. We've got to break it in America. And he wants to change the way we design things. He wants to go from find and fix to predict and manage. And he says this all the time. And he really means it. And to his credit, he's not an engineer, and he doesn't really think like one. He's trying to do something much bigger in a way than what engineers are trying to do. So I instantly sort of said he's a guy I want to hang out with a lot and see how he does what he does.
And I like that he's too modest to initially want the Dunmire process named after him.
You gave it away.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. No, it's okay. So the story of the Dunmire process is at a corrosion meeting only a couple years ago, a well-known German, I think a physicist with a PhD in nuclear physics or so anyway, a highly regarded engineer and physicist said Germany has to do what America is doing. And he called for the adoption of what he called the Dunmire process. And Dan Dunmire happened to be in the room and he turned bright red and got all wide eyed and said, you can't do that. You can't name something after me. But the German said, no, we mean it. And we're going to send someone over to your office and see what you do and how you do it. And we're going to adopt the same thing back home.
You know, Johnny, we don't think about this often. I mean, most of us. But rust is not only expensive, it can be dangerous. Metal fails and people die.
Yeah, it knocks down bridges. It takes planes out of the sky. It's killed people at nuclear reactors. It's blown water heaters through the roof. It's opened up crypts. I guess those people were already dead anyway. It's blown up manhole covers, sewers. It's killed a bunch of guys. Well, rust itself hasn't killed guys in the oil industry, but sort of fighting rust has. Pigs, which people use to clean pipelines and to inspect pipelines, have blown out of the ends of pipelines and decapitated people or impaled people. And that's basically because a pipeline is like a giant pressure box, and putting a pig in it is kind of like putting a missile inside.
We should be clear, these are robotic pigs. These are not, porcine animals running through a thing and decapitating people.
It's true, although I would not be surprised. I went to a pigging conference in Houston, and I heard some stories of what some of the guys are up to. I would not be surprised if someone once put a pig in a pipeline, a real pig.
So we all know what rust is, but can you kind of explain a little bit about how it affects metal and why it happens so quickly on some kinds of metal and why, for example, my gold wedding band shows no signs of rust, even though I wear it in the water and everywhere else?
Right. I like to think of it. So we all learned to think of rust as a chemical reaction back in high school, which makes us sort of file it away as something boring. So instead of thinking as a reaction, I like to think of it as a force. And it's the result of oxygen, which is the world's most abundant element, trying to steal electrons from pretty much every metal out there. I think all but four of them can be coaxed or induced to rust or corrode in some way or another. And you need oxygen, you need metal, and you need a pathway for the electrons to start moving. And water, particularly the ocean, is a really, really good pathway for that to happen. Gold, most people think it doesn't rust. You can create circumstances where it does, but for all intents and purposes, it's probably safe to think of it as rust-proof. Whereas stainless steel is definitely not rust-proof. It just stains less than other steels.
Hmm. I was really surprised to learn in your book that things in space can rust. I would have assumed they needed water and wind and other elements that we really associate with life on Earth.
Yeah, I was really surprised to hear that, too. I actually went to NASA's corrosion lab down on Cape Canaveral, hoping to learn a lot more about it. And I was sort of sidetracked because they have a corrosion lab on the beach where they have these little squares of metal up on racks, just getting exposed to the salty air and sometimes hurricanes. And they watch what happens to these pieces of metal, which are coated in different kinds of paints. And that's sort of the state of modern corrosion science. I mean, they do a bunch of research designing these paints and coatings, but they also wait and see. In space, we have atomic rather than molecular oxygen, which probably tries to steal electrons with even greater fury than here on Earth. But there's also no water floating around. So it strikes in relatively modest proportions compared to here.
Can rusting metal be recycled?
Of course. Yeah. Yeah, they do it. I mean, they do it at steelworks all over the country. They line up old rusty cars and they melt them back down into metal. And then I don't know how exactly they take off the slag, but you can get the products you want out of the metal and then have just iron left over.
So some stuff that rusts, we recycle. Some we just replace. But rusting things that we want to keep present pretty significant challenges. And the story of the Statue of Liberty, which had been sort of neglected, kind of taken for granted, and then had to be restored, is a fascinating part of the book.
Yeah, I couldn't believe how close the statue was to falling down. Engineers at one point deemed it structurally deficient. Some other engineers climbed up into the torch and took a picture of themselves sitting there. And when they showed this picture around an office, they were advised to never do that again because the frame that was supposed to be holding the torch in place had completely disintegrated. There was no frame anymore. Those guys ended up just sitting on copper that's about as thick as a penny. That would be pretty embarrassing if the national symbol of freedom or part of it fell over, particularly the torch, the symbol of light. So go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, so how did it happen that it was neglected for so long? Did people just not realize what was happening?
Yeah, so the designer of the statue, the best materials of the time were iron and copper. And he was well aware that if you put the two in touch, you get what's called galvanic corrosion, which is basically you form a big battery and the iron corrodes because the copper is there, sort of sucking away the electrons. So he knew this, and he tried to separate the two with asbestos, which was sort of the best thing he had going at the time. And he figured that since guys could climb inside the statue and look around, people would see any damage done. But over the years, superintendents of the park, I guess, ordered the statue painted on the inside. And paint was sort of the worst thing imaginable because not only did it trap water inside the copper, it also hid the interaction between the iron frame and the copper skin. And this happened 5 or 6 times. There were all these different coats of paint. And by the time the 80s rolled around and the superintendent then looked into the matter, it almost looked like metal-chomping beavers had eaten away the frame. I mean, a third of it was missing in places. A third of the rivets holding the iron to the copper had pulled out. It was all eventually replaced. Every single one of the iron ribs was replaced with an equal made of stainless steel. They actually left one, I think, I forget if it's in her right foot or left foot, but they left it for historians to eventually see what the original really was made of. But it was a remarkable fix, and we were almost lucky that we caught it in the first place.
And when you clean the Statue of Liberty, you can get rust from all kinds of peculiar places in Lady Liberty's body.
It's true. She had rust boogers. It's probably my favorite photo in the book. There's an architectural historian who's up on the scaffolding when they covered the whole statue in scaffolding to work on her. And she's up there with this huge measuring stick, and she's right below the nostrils. And you can see above her, there are these kind of gross, clumpy things in Lady Liberty's nose. And they're rust boogers. She also had I think what's called bronze plague on the rays of the spikes of her crown. She had some of the curls in her hair were totally disintegrated. She had kind of every ailment you can imagine coming from rust. Well, corrosion, but yeah.
Gal gets to a certain age and she needs a little work done. It's not so
That's
embarrassing.
That's right.
My guest is journalist Jonathan Waldman. We're talking about his new book, Rust, The Longest War. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Jonathan Waldman, whose new book is called Rust, The Longest War. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org, which is where we hear from Jim in Dallas, who wants to know, Johnny, is rust very slow fire or is fire very fast rust, or is it both?
I think it's both. I remember sort of having my mind blown when I learned that dynamite was sort of like even faster fire. But I guess for the purposes of this book, I tried to think of rust as its own force. But yeah, oxygen is involved in both. It's the same process, I suppose.
So people have dreamed for a long time of not having to deal with this problem. And I love the story of Harry Brearley, who's a pioneer in stainless steel. The amazing thing is he left school at 11 and got a job as a bottle washer for a chemist, which would have seemed like the end of the road. But that chemist made sure that his education continued.
Yeah, Harry Brearley was one of my favorite people. I obviously never talked to him. He died 70 years ago. But he was a stubborn guy, and he was kind of addicted to learning, and he was not one to take words of wisdom from just anybody. But he lucked out. This lab that he ended up working in was run by a very bright guy who saw to it that Brearley, if he could save time, he could sort of use the remainder of his hours doing experiments or doing whatever he wanted. So he sort of was given an incentive to be good at his work, and to spend even his free time learning more about his work. So by his 20s, he was reading everything he could about individual metals and compiling that information in note cards. And then he'd move on to another metal and compile all that information in note cards. And I think by 25, for fun, and he was a kind of a weird guy. He didn't really have hobbies. He used to put ink blots on paper and see what came out, and he called that a hobby.
That's a red flag right there on a dating
totally
website.
A red flag. Pretty nerdy guy. But by his mid-20s, there was a professor of metallurgy, I think, who used to come by with sample alloys and say, see how fast you can figure out what this is. And he prided himself on saying, oh yeah, this is like 0.03% phosphorus and 0.8% copper, and the rest is whatever. And that's what he did for fun. Is he'd go in on Saturdays, he'd walk miles and go in and just mess with metals. So it's sort of natural that it's he who stumbled across what we think of as stainless steel today. It was in 1913 he made an alloy for a munitions company in, I think, south of London. And he left it there at his lab, and he came back the next day and noticed that it wasn't staining, it wasn't rusting. And he told a cutler, he said, well, this stuff stains less. And the cutler says, well, that would be perfect for cutlery. Unfortunately, that cutler later accused Harry Brearley of making knives that won't cut because he couldn't. This cutler found himself unable to polish or grind or harden or sharpen this metal. So Harry Brearley sort of yet again had to show this other guy how to do it. And it turns out it was perfect for cutlery, among other things.
But Brearley wasn't the first one to stumble across an alloy that resembles what we now call stainless steel today. Why was he the one associated with it?
That's a good point. There were something, almost a dozen different guys who all around the same time, this is around 1913, and even 5 years earlier, had stumbled across some mixture of iron and chromium and even a little bit of molybdenum that makes steel sort of passivate in the presence of oxygen. And what it does is it forms a protective layer on the outside that keeps oxygen from getting to the inside layers. Brearley is sort of credited with the discovery because he was so darn pushy. His company, the steelworks that he worked for, they didn't really want anything to do with cutlery. So they said, we're not going to take this anywhere. And he said, no, it's good for everything from axles to spindles to plunger rods, parts of engines. And they said, you're so pushy and kind of annoying. And Brearley is the kind of guy who wouldn't let it go. And he ended up quitting. He ended up getting involved in a couple lawsuits where other people tried to take credit. And it's kind of because he sort of has steel in his blood that it's sort of fun to write. There were other guys who worked on stainless steels and alloys, but Brearley almost deserves the credit. So.
And what exactly is in stainless steel that makes it so miraculous?
I think technically the definition of stainless steel, and I hope I don't flub this, it's something between, I want to say, 8 and 18% chromium. Molybdenum makes it even more stainless, but it's that chromium. I mean, it's going to be hard to explain in words real quickly, but it's that mixture, that composition is what makes stainless steel behave the way it does.
And we've probably all experienced the differences, like the kind with more molybdenum or whatever is in sort of the nice flatware that you'd buy for your home. And then the flatware you eat with at a diner, you can sometimes see evidence of rust on that.
Yeah, I guess I haven't been to that diner before.
I should turn the fork back in.
Yeah, it would make me smile if I saw rust on any of my flatware. But the funny thing is, Harry Brearley, because he had no education and he was the youngest of eight kids, he was the one who was ordered, or I guess instructed by his mother, to wash and dry the cutlery. And back then, you didn't just put it in the little rack next to your sink or the dishwasher and let it sit there. If you did, it would rust. So as the guy who did all this maintenance at home, he always sort of was thinking, like, there's got to be a way around this. So it's sort of no surprise that a guy like Brearley thought, aha, this is perfect for cutlery, before he thought, aha, this is perfect for any number of other things.
Okay, based on your descriptions, the typical corrosion engineer in America is middle-aged, mustachioed, and not exactly brimming with work-related humor.
It's true, and I'm going to get a bunch of flack for corrosion engineers for saying that, but in my book, I try to... Some of them I see as heroes. They're doing a lot of work that most of us think we're better than. They pay attention to stuff that most of us would prefer to ignore. There's a joke about all engineers, though, so this might put them in good company. They say that even an extroverted engineer looks at your shoes while he's talking to you. And I did find some corrosion engineers who were very vibrant. They shared their stories. I think they've learned to put up with kind of this ridiculous situation in which the most abundant element is attacking the thing they're assigned to save. But I went to some corrosion conferences, and yeah, I mean, maybe it's just because I'm a young guy and I'm kind of snarky. But most of them were older than me. Most of them had mustaches. Most of them were more into golf than running. But that's fine. I mean, America's like that.
And occasionally they're named Rusty.
Yeah, I think there's a dozen of them named Rusty, corrosion engineers named Rusty. I was really hoping to meet a guy named Will Rust, but not one Will Rust is a corrosion engineer. They're lawyers and doctors and graphic artists.
Why do so many of them settle in Texas?
I think about half of corrosion engineers are involved in the oil and gas industry, and that's where the oil and gas industry is. So, and also, the National Association of Corrosion Engineers is based in Houston. So it sort of makes sense that they're around there. And it's a pretty rusty place.
All right, let's go back to the issue of pipelines, because, again, I think this is something that maybe we don't give a lot of thought to. We might assume that every 25 years you have to replace pipe segments, but there are federal requirements that these pipeline segments, like the Trans-Alaska pipeline, be inspected every single year.
Well, not every single year. Federal requirements are every 5 years,
okay.
And that's not even on all pipeline. That's on the transmission lines and on major transmission lines that cross state lines. If you run a tiny little pipeline, it's 5 miles long and it's in the middle of Arkansas, you probably don't have to abide by the federal laws that apply to the big guys. That said, the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, which manages the Trans-Alaska pipeline system, they inspect their line every 3 years, but that's sort of because they're the most regulated pipeline on Earth and have a number of agencies telling them how to operate and kind of looking over their shoulders. But to their credit, they take it very, very seriously, and they inspect their pipeline more often than anybody else.
How big are those pipelines? Or how big is the Trans-Alaska?
The Trans-Alaska pipeline is 4 feet in diameter, which means if you tried to hug it, you'd get about halfway around it. And I did this, you know, and you think you'd hear the oil flowing through it, but you can't. The oil flows very smoothly. It's not warm or cold. It just feels like you're hugging a big solid tube.
It would seem as if the oil would protect the pipeline from rust. Is that not the case?
It is the case, but it's not entirely the case. And here's the thing is, the oil that came out of the ground in 1859 in Pennsylvania happened to be very non-corrosive. It was light and it was sweet, which means it didn't have a lot of hydrogen sulfide in it. And so the guys who built the first pipelines 5 or 6 years later were really lucky because the stuff didn't attack their pipelines. But there are other oils that are way more corrosive, and the oil up in Alaska actually is about 3% water. And if you're moving oil 800 miles across a state, the oil cools off as it flows, and eventually you get a separate layer of water on the bottom inside the pipeline. And so this is a pretty big threat to the pipeline. But you also have a pipeline buried. And so even if the inside of the pipeline isn't rusting, the outside of the pipeline, where it may come into contact with dirt or water or sharp rocks, can break through the paint, and then you get water actually hitting the metal, that's where a pipeline can rust also.
And those magical robotic pigs that go through, they don't actually make repairs. They simply document where problems exist and need to be fixed.
Yeah. So calling them, I like calling them magical. They're almost magical, but they'd be really magical if they went and made repairs as they went. Instead, they're kind of like computerized note takers. You turn them on, you put them in at one end, and then you send them on their way like a giant spitball in a huge straw. And they keep track of how thick or thin the metal is as they go. And they record, on the Alaska pipeline, for example, they record all 7 billion inches of the pipeline. And then at the end, they yank this pig out very carefully. And then they download something like 400 gigabytes of data. And they examine that data very, very carefully. And they assign, they sort of color code it. And you'll see red, yellow, and green. And the red stuff, they go and they work on it right away. They might go dig up the pipeline and install a sleeve or weld on a new spot. And the green stuff, they say, that's like, it's not really a threat. We'll add that to the list, but it's not where the pipeline's going to burst.
Does the pipeline have to be empty? Because you write about the problem of wax forming along the sort of inner lining of it.
Very much the pipeline is not empty. It's still full. It's the pig is propelled by the flow of oil behind it. They also do this in gas pipelines, and the gas is what pushes the pig forward. And one of the cruxes on the Alaska pipeline is that as they run out of oil, and oil has been decreasing about 5% every year for 20 years now, as they run out of oil, there's almost not enough to keep that pig pushing forward, because this thing weighs 5 tons and it's 16 feet long. So they've spent a lot of energy coming up with the ideal pig design and finding the right one for their pipeline and making conditions optimal for pushing this pig. Because the worst thing imaginable is the pig either comes apart or it gets stuck or it just stalls in place. And now you have a pipeline. Basically, it's like a kink in a hose. You don't want the pressure to build up too high behind something in a pipeline that shouldn't really be there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Sharon in Fort Worth. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. I just had a nice little laugh listening to the conversation. I turned the radio in midstream, but I do understand personalities and engineers, mm-hmm. And how they are introvert, some maybe extrovert, less or so. But I just wanted to recount a story that happened to me. I am an engineer. And when I was working in industry, I was introducing our chief engineer at a meeting we were in. And one of the comments that I made was, well, unlike most of us, he does have a personality. And they had reviews they did at the end. And that one comment kind of dominated like, you know, half of the comments back, that they were kind of offended that I made that comment. But it is kind of true that in the industry that most engineers, and I hate to say that that way, it's like it's an introversion, you know, that you kind of take things, you look at them critically, analytically, that type thing. And so now I work at a shoe shop, and my thing is I do stare at people's shoes. And it's like okay, yeah, I have to substantiate his claim because it's like that is me. But anyway, it's just a nice conversation. And I did work in petroleum. I worked for Schlumberger Well Services as a wire engineer, wire log engineer. So it's mm-hmm. like the whole conversation just seems like it just came back to me, but I'm loving it. That's
well,
what I'm going to do.
Sharon, thank you for your call. She certainly sounds like she's got a great personality. And we should say, you know, I suppose you need certain people who are going to focus not on the silly things in life, but on the problem at hand. And that's what makes engineers so brilliant.
Right. And I love that she just corroborated my story. Maybe I can stand back and let it stand there. But it's true. Yeah, we can't all laugh at everything, and we can't all be serious. There's got to be this mix. And maybe that's my position as a writer, where I get to say things that are perhaps sensitive to some guys, but I don't think they're wrong.
So, Johnny, when I was a kid, my parents bought like a Chevy Malibu Classic, and they were super excited because they paid a little extra. We were living in New York at the time to get this special coating called Rusty Jones that meant that it would not rust out at the bottom like all the other cars did in, you know, winter with the salt and sludge. What works to prevent rust? What does is paint the way to go? Are there other coatings? What have we learned about that?
I love this question because people always bring up cars. And there's only so many things we can do to fight rust. You can coat stuff. You can galvanize stuff. You can electroplate stuff. You can use anodes, which people in boats have. They sort of sacrifice themselves to save the bigger metal thing you want to save. Or you can use cathodic protection, in which you push current into something to sort of keep the electrons there. And there were a number of products available, aftermarket products that hook up to your battery and, in theory, cathodically protected cars. And the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, has pretty much said that all of them are scams. And what they did is they said, look, this would work in a fish tank or underwater, but this would not work in a car because you don't have that thing you need, which is a medium for the electrons to migrate. They said if for this to work, you'd need like a million little wires hooked up to every little square centimeter of your car. And that's not what these products entail. The good news with cars is that since about the year 2000, paints have gotten so good at sticking to steel. And it's funny that a lot of rust science has to do with how well paint sticks, but so it goes. That if you've bought a car since 2000, you probably don't need to have it rusty Jones, then you probably don't need to worry about it rusting away before, you know, your own body does.
We don't get a ton of rust here, but we don't get a ton of rain here either. So maybe that's a bonus living in North Texas.
And they don't salt the roads there, which is also a big deal.
Yeah. We're speaking with journalist Jonathan Waldman about his new book, Rust, The Longest War. You can be part of the conversation by finding me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, by emailing think@kera.org, or by calling in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies Program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Jonathan Waldman, author of the new book, Rust, The Longest War. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Johnny, before I had a coffee habit, I mean, I probably popped open thousands of cans of Diet Coke in my young adulthood. And I never once really thought, what a brilliant piece of technology I'm drinking my carbonated, chemical-laden beverage from. But now I realize that I should have paid more attention.
Yeah. So the first thing is, it's funny how our brains work like that, right? You see something all the time and you stop thinking about it. And that's sort of what happened with rust, and that's definitely what happens with aluminum cans. So I say that because I am a graduate of can school, which happened a couple years ago. Well, it happens every year, but I went a couple years ago, just down the road where I live in north of Denver in Colorado. It's put on by the world's largest can-making company, and it's an industry-only event. I think I was the first journalist to attend, and I was probably the last journalist to attend, and here's why. It turns out that the aluminum can is so fantastically engineered to keep something like Coke inside it that the guys at Can School talk about cans as time bombs, and that's because it's amazing that we can put something like battery acid, basically, inside a can that's a few thousandths of an inch thick and keep it from exploding or leaking and keep it intact on a shelf in a fridge for a year or a warehouse for a year. So there's a great deal of science that goes into keeping the product, which is what the industry likes to call the beverages inside. They need to keep the product from interacting with the aluminum, and they do this with an epoxy coating. They call it an IC for internal coating. They insist it's organic, but as we'll get to in a second, a number of poisonous things are also organic, so that doesn't really mean much. The coating is 80% BPA. That's bisphenol A, the controversial chemical that people went a little bit, got excited about in baby bottles.
Right.
It's an endocrine disruptor. It turns out to be probably much more damaging to women's health than men's health, but I'm not a doctor. Either way, it's scary when you look at some of the effects it has. And the FDA regulates how much of this stuff can actually be picked up by beverages and end up in liquid and in our bodies. But there's a scientist out there who says this threshold that's tolerable is off by anywhere from 1 to 8 orders of magnitude. And this we sort of knew going into it, but I went to can school to find out about how much of that coating is really in a can. And for something really corrosive like Mountain Dew, there's a lot more of it on a can protecting the aluminum than there is in, say, beer. Which is good news if you like to drink can from beer from a can. The bad news is that I talked to a guy who works at the Coatings Research Institute in Michigan, who said that he has patents on some of these coatings, and he knows what goes into them. And he said, I won't drink out of a can. I won't allow cans in my house. I know what can go wrong. And that was a surprise to me.
So what would happen to, say, Coca-Cola or Mountain Dew or V8 if we put it into an uncoated aluminum can?
I think they would corrode in about 3 days. You would not be able to go to the store. You wouldn't have Coke machines. You wouldn't be able to take it out of a fridge. It would just be a big gloppy mess everywhere.
And what happened before the coatings existed? Was that like tin cans would get all funky?
Yeah, so there was this great hurry to figure out how to put beer in cans. Beer is really, really susceptible to impurities, and it wants to react in other ways with tin or with oxygen or with iron. So there was this great struggle in the 30s, I believe, to come up with a design for a can that kept the beer good and pressurized, but didn't ruin its flavor. And the secret turns out to be, well, now the secret's an epoxy coating, but it was something close to an epoxy coating back then. And it's amazing. Back then, I have some poems in my book. One of them sort of is an homage to the can. And back then, it was, you know, amazing enough was just the fact that you could put beer in a can and ship it around the world, and guys everywhere could have it and not go hungry. Now we're learning that the way we've made a lot of these modern marvels, that there's kind of more to it than we once thought. And I'm not anti-can. I think all the can companies out there, and especially the coatings companies, are looking to make safer coatings, but no single can company is going to say, oh, yeah, we'll raise the cost of our beverages just because we want to do the right thing, because it's a huge market. And if every can of Coke cost a penny more than it already did, they would lose a ton of market share. So until some sort of federal law says that all coatings have to change, it's very unlikely that any major manufacturer is going to come along and do it first. A couple tiny ones have. That's kind of a niche market. They say, well, we sell tomatoes in a non-BPA lined can, but it costs a lot.
You don't have that ode to a can memorized, do you?
I don't, but I have it right here if you want me to read it.
Read a bit of it for us. Yes, thank you.
Okay, hold on a second. Let's see. Gosh. Now the pressure's on.
This is radio magic here.
Do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
I'll give the phone number while you look. We are speaking this hour to Jonathan Waldman. He's a journalist, and he has a book out called Rust, The Longest War. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Did you find it?
I did. Right. So it's from 1918. It was delivered by Colonel William Grove of the Quartermaster Corps of the U.S. Army. Here's what he said in Boston. He said, we can march without shoes, we can fight without guns, we can fly without wings to flap over the Huns, we can sing without bands, parade without banners, but no modern army can eat without canners.
Bravo. 1-800-933-5372, our number. Let's go to Suzanne in Plano. Hey, Suzanne.
Hi, this is Suzanne.
Suzanne, hi.
Yes. I called in because I'm so excited to hear this, and it's my first time ever to call a radio program. My father, Robert James Kuhn, in 1928, devised and applied for the first time a method called cathodic protection. And it was then used to basically prevent the corrosion of pipes in the whole industry of the gas pipelines that were being laid out. And his invention, he got honored finally by the German Engineering Society and dubbed the father of cathodic protection in 1972. But his method he devised in 1928 was come about due to, he was a young engineer from Tulane University, graduated in 23, and was employed by what is today Entergy, at that time was NOPC. And this is all in New Orleans, where we're from. But what had happened was there was a lawsuit of one utility against another claiming that they were causing their pipes to corrode. The water board was claiming the utility company was causing it, and they put Dad as a young engineer to try and figure out what the problem was, and this is where he came up with the idea that the revolutionary area said that they were going to prevent the corrosion of pipes because when a pipe is buried underground, it comes in contact with various chemicals in the earth, setting up a positive electrical field. Since corrosion occurs only where small currents leave a pipe, the idea is to prevent those currents from leaving.
Well, that's all really interesting. Are you familiar with that story or that era in history, Johnny?
I'm definitely familiar with the era. There's the National Association of Corrosion Engineers basically began in the oil industry. And actually for the first 10 or 20 years, a lot of people didn't know that to join it, you didn't have to be in the oil industry. And even guys working at NACE had no idea that they served any other industries besides the oil and gas industry. And there's a lot of really interesting lawsuits that come from that time. There was a famous one in Arkansas in which a pipeline operator wanted to, the state wanted to build a reservoir over a place where a pipeline was already buried. And the pipeline operator said, but that's gonna make our pipeline corrode. You're going to have to give us millions of dollars. And the state said, actually, it might make it corrode less fast. And this ended up in front of a judge. And the best evidence presented was one guy said, anyone who tries to predict what's going to happen to a pipeline is kind of full of hogwash. It wasn't entirely true, but it was really funny. The judge said, I basically have no idea how to deal with this.
What about plumbing pipes? There used to be iron, and now everybody's switching over to PVC. I would have to imagine that iron still lasts longer, even if it eventually corrodes.
Yeah, one of the interesting things in plumbing is that, as I mentioned with the Statue of Liberty, with galvanic corrosion, when you put, say, iron in touch with copper, then you get really bad corrosion. And so as plumbers go around and replace, we're trying to replace a lot of old iron pipes, especially in oil and gas pipelines. And as you replace them, they need to be insulated where they're connected. And so this happens in houses, too. In the 70s, a lot of houses were built with aluminum wires instead of copper. But then they come back to the circuit box and they're connected. And at some point, aluminum touches copper and you get corrosion there. And that's caused a bunch of house fires. So iron pipes corrode. Every kind of pipe you can think of, if it's made of metal, it can corrode. And where they meet is sort of especially dangerous or susceptible.
You gained an aesthetic appreciation for rust over the course of your research. Can you talk about hanging out with Alicia Eve? Is it Chuck? Is that how you say her name in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania?
I think it's pronounced Sook.
Sook, okay.
Sook, yeah. Alicia Eve Sook is a fantastic photographer whose grandfather was a steelworker, and she lives in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, the home of the Bethlehem Steelworks, which at one time was the second largest steelworks in the world. And she's gone to art school. She has snuck into the Bethlehem Steelworks almost 400 times. And she's taken about 30,000 photos of rust. And when she shows these photos to former steelworkers who still hang around Bethlehem and even work at the abandoned steelworks guarding it, they say, I had no idea rust could be so beautiful. Her stuff is absolutely stunning. It's on the cover of my book and on the inside flaps as you open it. Some of her images look like animal skins or like Japanese watercolors, anything you can imagine. One looks like the aurora. One sort of vaguely looks like a forest landscape. People have told her that she photographs the steelworks like the old guys used to photograph the West at the right time of day with the wide lens and the light just right. And everyone else insist on calling the steelworks abandoned or shuttered or decayed or dying. And it's true. It's abandoned. The steelworks, you know, it's It's a symbol of the death of American steelmaking in 70s, 80s, and even into the 90s. But she's wrested this stuff into these fantastic images. And the first time I saw one in Pennsylvania, I almost wanted to reach into the image. Her stuff is so rich. She doesn't manipulate it. She doesn't change the colors or the tones. It's kind of the devotion she gives to what nature is busy doing to this material that we all want to use.
It's remarkable because a lot of our assumption that rust is ugly, I think, just comes from the fact that we associate it with things breaking down. But if you take it out of that context, it really is lovely. And it comes, we should say, in tons of different colors.
Tons of different colors. And in my book, I go into the way that different metals, some metals turn purple, some turn blue, some turn yellow. Most of us think of rust as reddy brown, you know, the color of bricks or Mars or Mexican tile. Alicia manages to capture all these colors, and it's funny. She's told me, she read the chapters in my book, and she said, "Gosh, everywhere people are fighting rust, I wish I could have been there to see it, because I'm sure I could have found some beauty."
And I mean, she's been caught more than once, right?
She's been caught. The steelworks has been abandoned since '95. It's been purchased by a casino company. And so they sort of fenced off the main area and they turned the rest into a casino. And so she's got permission to go there. She's supposed to stay on the ground floor. But nevertheless, the guards there, they worry about her safety. So when they catch her, they tell her, you know, you're gonna get attacked by either druggies hanging out here, or we're going to have to get the cadaver dogs when you go missing someday. They really try to dissuade her from going back there, but she can't resist. She's brave.
We have a quick email here from Sandra who wants to know if those coatings that you described are also in canned foods or only in beverages.
They're in foods and beverages. And the weird thing is, or the amazing thing is, there's kind of a particular coating for every particular food or beverage because different chemicals react differently with coatings. So there's one for fish, one for beans, one for corn. Spam has its own coating, so the meat slides right out. And if you didn't like spam before, that probably won't make you like it much more. There's coatings for everything, and they're all tailored just to it. Rhubarb is one of the most corrosive things because of the pigment. I think it's called anthocyanin. And so rhubarb actually has one of the thickest coatings in a can out there. But it's in foods and beverages.
Whatever happened to your boat?
My buddy sailed her to Australia. And then I guess some guy bought the boat. And I actually dedicate my book to whoever it was that bought the boat, because it's so good to have it off my hands.
The two happiest days in a man's life, right, are when he buys his
that's
boat
right,
and when he sells it.
That's exactly right.
The new book by journalist Jonathan Waldman is called Rust, The Longest War. Johnny, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thanks. That was fun.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Celine Alba. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. On Twitter, I am at Chris Boyd Think. And if you'd like to send email to the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.